Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic correspondent, here as always with editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz. We are probably the last podcast in the world that has not analyzed Will Smith slapping Chris Rock, but I think we have way too much news in Israel. I think Bennett just had a slap in the face this morning as we're recording it, a figurative one.
Oh, that's a great comparison. I didn't think of that.
Yes. from Edith Silman, someone who I don't think we've ever mentioned on the podcast, which is, I think, indicative of something. She, until this morning, was coalition chairwoman, which is similar to a whip in the American or British.
The majority whip, exactly. In
the American or British parliaments. And the fact that we haven't really mentioned her at all, I think, is somewhat indicative of the fact that she was a very weak one and was not amazing at the job.
She's getting her 15 minutes of fame, and I think you just did her a huge favor by mentioning her in the same sentence as Will Smith. So, you know,
right.
There's a lot for her today.
It was a thankless job in the first place in a coalition with eight different parties on a broad ideological spectrum. But this morning she resigned and said she is no longer voting with the coalition because she wants to defend Jewish identity. Specifically, earlier this week, she was upset about the issue that people are allowed to bring chametz, like leavened food, into hospitals during Passover. So not kosher for Passover food, which, to give 2 seconds of background, the Supreme Court ordered this. So then one hospital said they were going to suggest to people that they not bring food that's not kosher for Passover. And then the health minister from Meretz, Nitzan Horowitz, said that he's not going to allow them to even suggest it. So Silman got really mad. Right. But this is sort of an excuse. It's clear that dissatisfaction in the Yamina party with this coalition and the fact that it's not actually a right-wing coalition has been building up for a long, long time.
I just want to say one thing about the chametz issue.
Yeah.
So 15 years ago, our second daughter was born. And she was born on Chol HaMoed Pesach. So in the interim days between the front and the end of Pesach. And when you still are not allowed to eat chametz, and my mother came to the hospital, wanted to bring some food in. It was at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, and they wouldn't let her bring food in. Now, obviously, I mean, not obviously, but our food was kosher for Passover, no chametz, and they wouldn't let her bring it in. So for a long time, it's actually bothered me, this whole thing of why are we going into people's bags? Why can't people just bring food that they want, right? Let people eat what they want. So I'm saying this on podcast, but I do think that this whole chametz thing is a little ridiculous. People should be able to eat what they want, where they want, and let's not, you know, obviously I wouldn't want people throwing a party of chametz in a hospital, but that's not going to happen. Someone's sitting in their bed, let them have their home cooked meal.
Right.
We shouldn't be inspecting, you know, does this have bread or not have bread? Is it chametz? Is it not chametz? Because basically what it means is no one can bring in food. But look, like you said, that's not the reason that Edith Silman is really quitting the coalition. The reason Edith Silman is quitting the coalition is because she is fed up with the coalition and the prices that she's had to pay ideologically and politically to remain in this coalition. And that's really what's behind it. And the question now, Lahav, and maybe you can explain to us, is what's going to happen, right? Is this government going to be able to keep it together?
To give people an idea of, like, you know, the ideological and public consequences, on Monday, her husband, Edith Silman's husband, Shmulik Silman, was on Galei Israel, which is like a right-wing radio station. And he was like, he basically said, I have the tweet in front of me from the radio station. He said that that he thinks the Yamina party committed to certain things and they have to apologize to the public. Everyone in the whole country knows that they lied to the public. So imagine, like, your spouse at home saying those things. And it could be that at that point she already knew she was going to quit. But I think that a lot of the Israeli right and religious Israelis, so, you know, the public and the communities from which she came, were putting a lot of pressure on her. Anyway, so moving forward, you know, to speculate what could happen next, I think the most likely scenario is an election. But if we sort of game this out, right now the Knesset is in recess, so probably nothing will happen. It's going to be in recess for a little over a month, so probably nothing really will happen in the next month. Because in order for an election to be called, the Knesset would have to be convened for a special vote. And I think that this current coalition will want to coast along for at least that 1 month. And certainly they're not going to, the Knesset speaker, who is from this coalition, is not going to convene the Knesset because the opposition wants to bring down the coalition. So we probably have a month or so. After that, I think it's going to be really hard for this coalition to survive. It only has 60 seats. It does not have the 61 seat majority. To begin with, for months, it was failing to pass a lot of things in the Knesset. And they're just not really going to be able to get anything done and will fall apart, is my prediction.
Either way, yes. I think that the days of Naftali Bennett as prime minister are coming to a potential end,
yes.
Right? Because if we go to an election, if the Knesset is dispersed, let's say the opposition and particularly Netanyahu is able to get another member of the coalition to join and join the opposition.
That's not enough.
Right. Then
that's the thing. People keep saying, oh, Netanyahu needs one more and then he has a majority. It's not true because the joint list is in the opposition.
No, but he could pass a law to disperse the Knesset and take Israel to an election.
Right? Yes.
What's known as Chok Lepizur HaKnesset. Right. So he won't be able to form a coalition, but he'll be able to bring down the government and lead Israel to an election. And then in that interim period, Yair Lapid becomes prime minister.
He has to get the joint list on his side, and they haven't promised that. And I there is a scenario in which that I think we should discuss, and that we've alluded to it in the past. I think there is a scenario in which there won't be an election, and that scenario is one in which Netanyahu convinces Gantz to join up with him, because Gantz has enough seats for Netanyahu to have a majority in the Knesset, a 62 seat majority, and Gantz has been very unhappy in this coalition. Now, I think what Netanyahu would have to do is agree to a rotation in which Gantz would be prime minister first, but he might be desperate enough to want to do that and not have an election. So that's a possibility.
The reason he might want to do that is because, like, if they bring down the government in a dispersion law, and then we go to an election, Yair Lapid automatically becomes prime minister. And Yair Lapid remains prime minister until the establishment of a new government. And as we've seen, Bibi has trouble forming governments. So that could be a number of elections, and that could be over a long period of time, which would build up Lapid, bring down Gantz and Bibi. So I would argue that Gantz wouldn't want Lapid to be prime minister, Bibi wouldn't want Lapid to be prime minister, and therefore they would compromise to be able to try to find some sort of solution, potentially.
That being said, Netanyahu already betrayed Gantz once.
So why not do it again?
No, well, so Gantz, I mean, you know, it's like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Like, is Gantz foolish enough to think that Netanyahu won't stab him in the back again?
He might be.
He might be.
The argument could be, I'm preventing another election, right? So it's, I have to take this risk to be able to keep Israel stable and not going to another election. Look, who knows? I think it's basically, if we thought that the Knesset was on recess and Pesach was going to be a quiet holiday, things have shaken up a bit for the Israeli political system.
Yes, definitely not a quiet Pesach. One can say that Pesach is what instigated this. And I will say that if we go a little bit deeper, I do think that some of the what we call diplomatic issues in Israel are behind this election as well, because the settlers or the residents of Judea and Samaria have been very angry at Bennett. And I think they've really upped their rhetoric and their accusations. And that is part of what should have been, or what used to be, Bennett's base. And certainly the pressure, increased public pressure on members of his Yamina party. As we speak, like a few hours after we're speaking, there's supposed to be a huge rally of the right with Netanyahu speaking. There have been some rallies since Bennett became prime minister, but this is expected to be a big one. All of the sort of the communities in Judea and Samaria, all of their mayors have been coming out against Bennett. And I tie this to Israel's international affairs because I think, you know, the U.S., they wanted to keep this coalition alive because they felt that it was sort of more amenable to what the U.S. wants than Netanyahu. But the Biden administration has been putting nonstop pressure on Bennett on the settlement issue. And so Bennett has barely been able to budge on it. And Bennett had said repeatedly at the beginning of his term as prime minister that he was going to continue construction in existing settlements, right? Growing these communities where they need to be grown, but not expanding. But he's barely even made progress on that because as people in Bennett's office have said to me, that the Biden administration is sort of obsessed with the issue of settlements and settlers. So I think that actually the Biden administration that wanted to keep this government together played a role in its downfall. It's not the only thing, but I think it played a role.
It's interesting. I mean, look, I also think that Bennett kind of neglected his party, right?
Definitely.
He was very focused on mediating, for example, between Ukraine and Russia. He was focused on a lot of the diplomatic issues that a prime minister needs to deal with, but he wasn't focused on his own party. And he was shocked from what we're reporting on what happened and Edith Sielman's decision to quit the coalition. He didn't see it coming. And that shows a deficit within his circle and just where his attention was. This should have been, you know, you can gallivant around the world, you can participate in peace summits, you can meet the president and the prime minister of countries everywhere,
you can try to mediate
peace, you know, summits with Sisi and MBZ and Sharm el Sheikh, but one Knesset member can cause you more trouble than all of those people put together potentially. And that's what we're seeing also play out here.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think that Bennett somewhat fell in love with being a statesman. And that's legitimate. I mean, it's not a bad thing. I think that he was doing pretty good things for Israel on the international stage overall. You know, no one's perfect, but overall. But he was very preoccupied with that. And it's sort of the opposite of what he said he would be doing when he came into office, because he was saying that Israel has so many domestic issues and it needs to be stabilized and we need to deal with the economy and COVID, etc. He did deal with COVID, less so the economy. That's been the job of other people. But he is so internationally focused when the problems at home sort of overwhelmed him.
The issue of the possible election, Lahav, at this stage, what do you think is the chances that that's where we're headed?
That we're headed to an election? I think that's the most likely scenario, an election in like the last quarter of this year.
There you have it, people. Lahav Harkov with her prediction for the last quarter of 2022. Lahav, one other issue that came up this week, you know, amid all of the counterterrorism efforts that Israel has been kind of focused on with in the last few weeks, we've had 11 Israelis who were murdered in different terrorist attacks, one in Hadera, Be'er Sheva, then Hadera, then B'nai Brak. There's been shooting attacks. IDF troops are deployed across the country. I saw them the other night at just an outside street fair. They are also deployed along the security barrier, wherever there are holes, trying to stop them. There's counter-terrorist operations that have been taking place, like the one that was in Jenin, where they stopped these terrorists who were on their way to an attack. Mm-hmm. But there was also this issue of Bucha in Ukraine, and the government's kind of wavering on the condemnation. What exactly happened there?
So over the weekend, these really horrific and tragic photos came to light of this town, Bucha, in Ukraine. It's near Kiev. The Ukrainian army succeeded in getting the Russian army out of there and found, you know, corpses littering the street, mass graves. Some of the people who were dead had their hands tied behind their backs and appeared to have been shot at short range. So very quickly, on Sunday already, Foreign Minister Yair Lapid said that this is a war crime. I mean, most of the Western world had been calling it a war crime. And Lapid joined in.
Right.
Now, Bennett said nothing until Tuesday. So that's 4 days after the pictures came to light. He only said it when he was asked about it, although since I speak to people in his office, he did expect to be asked about it. It was sort of the first opportunity for press to ask him questions. But he could have also gone out of his way to release a statement. I mean, it's truly, you know, people who study genocide are saying that this looks like it could be called genocide, similar to like Srebrenica in the Balkans, you know, where like all of the men in a city were killed. It was thousands of people. You know, and he was being quiet, but there was this a lot of a public sort of discussion of why isn't he saying anything? Should we be saying things? Which personally, I thought he should have said something. And so then he finally did. And he talked about it being sort of horrifying, but he didn't use the word war crimes and he didn't blame Russia for it. So he's sort of continuing in the formulation from the first month of the war. But I think that when you have something that could be called genocide, and even if it's not, it's just so clearly war crimes, so clearly horrific that it's worth considering changing the rhetoric, you know? Like, I think I was pretty understanding of why Bennett was not blaming Russia up until now, because there really are security interests of Israel in Syria dealing with Iran that we need to care about. But, you know, just morally, like, how long can you not call that out? And I think that as a leader, a leader has a moral role as well. Now, Gantz was asked about it, and Gantz has not said a lot about Ukraine this entire time. And Gantz himself called it a war crime. And then when he was asked, well, now that we're blaming Putin for war crimes, like, what are we going to do in Syria? And Gantz's response was, we'll be able to do what we need to defend ourselves. So that's vague. But I think, first of all, the coordination in Syria is in Russia's interest as well. So while Putin's decision making doesn't seem entirely rational or fully informed these days, there is a good chance that he will continue to coordinate with Israel. And also, you know, what is the point at which we have to say this is not someone who we can be seen as working with? I think these are very big questions.
I think they're big questions, and it was good to finally hear some condemnations, but I think that you're right. In the condemnation that Bennett issued the other day, he did refrain from mentioning Putin or mentioning Russia. Israel is being very careful here, right? And seems that very concerned despite what Gantz had said. But I think that we come back to something that we've spoken about, you know, frequently in the last few weeks is, what does the country stand for, right? It has to symbolize something that's greater than just a security interest, for example. There are people who don't agree with that. They think that, you know, Israel just needs to look after itself and shouldn't care about other things. I don't know that. I definitely don't accept that. I think that you've also expressed hesitancy from that as well.
Well, I do think, as far as what does Israel stand for, that this government has been standing up for, you know, Aliyah, for our role as a protector and as a haven for the Jewish people. And, you know, and I think that that's been the right thing to do. You know, on that level, to maintain open channels with the Russian Jewish community is very important. But again, I don't know that not speaking up against really such horrific acts is the way to do that.
So this week, our guest is someone who really doesn't have anything to do with the politics in Israel. And we talk a bit about Ukraine, but that's not really why he's here. His name is Rabbi Dr. Ari Lam. He's the chief executive of B'nai Tzion and the co-founder of Soul Shop Studios and host of the Good Faith Effort weekly podcast on Bible and society. We spoke with Ari because he has encountered something very interesting recently in a series of tweets about why it's important to study the Bible in Hebrew. These tweets have been blowing up, and it's led to some interesting understandings of, I think, what people are interested in, particularly not just Jews, but particularly Christians, of how when you study the Torah or the Bible in the original language, what that does to learning and to your understanding of Jewish tradition and history and religion, of course. And we also spoke to him about the upcoming holiday, Pesach, which is next week, and the lessons that the holiday of when the Jews were refugees from Egypt, how does that resonate today with the refugee crisis in Europe due to the war in Ukraine? Rabbi Dr. Ari Lam, here we go. So our guest this week is Rabbi Dr. Ari Lam, chief executive of B'nai Tzion, co-founder of Soul Shop Studios, host of The Good Faith Effort, a weekly podcast on Bible and society. He served before as special advisor to the president of Yeshiva University, lots of different titles and great experience. And Rabbi Lam, Ari, the reason we're having you on is because we're ahead of Pesach, we're ahead of Passover. Lots to talk about, lots going on in the world. But what I think is very interesting is that you recently posted a 25-tweet, something like that, thread with a lesson of why it's important to read the Bible, the Torah, in Hebrew. And you were doing it on your own, right? It was kind of just a thought, a feeling. But when you went back into Twitter a few hours later, you found that this thing blew up. So why don't you tell us what happened and what you were trying to do with this Twitter thread?
Well, thanks for having me back, guys. This is always a tremendous amount of fun. So yeah, it was a crazy thing. I had just engaged with a friend of mine. So on the podcast, you mentioned that I do Good Faith Effort. I had on someone I admired for a long time named Zena Hitz. She's a professor at St. John's College, which is like this great books program. And this, you know, very prestigious college, and she had written this great book, about the importance of learning for its own sake. So, you know, what you might call in the Jewish tradition, you know, Torah Lishma, learning for its own sake, you know, and her book is called Lost in Thought. It's excellent. And she was writing it sort of from a Catholic perspective. And I'd read the book, I was enthralled by it. And so I had on the podcast to talk about, you know, our respective religious communities' perspective on the importance of learning and education and study and the joys of study. And a little bit later, she kind of reached, you know, we sort of maintained a friendship, and she's great on Twitter. And she reached out to me a little while later and said, hey, you know, I've kind of started this thing called the Catherine Project. And what the Catherine Project does is she sort of took advantage of how everything went online during the pandemic and created these kind of communities and friendships and fellowships around learning. And the ambition that she had was to make, you know, humanistic learning, liberal arts learning about any topic, like whether it's Kierkegaard, Aristotle, Plato, the Bible, learning Greek, you know, Chinese, Hebrew, whatever it is, making it available to anybody from any walk of life, old, young, whatever your background, totally for free, and making, you know, available, you know, quality teachers who could walk students through this. It's an amazing initiative, and it's, you know, been written up at a bunch of places. And she said to me, you know, we'd love to put together a class to teach biblical Hebrew. So, you know, would you be interested? And I said, I would definitely be interested, but, you know, just, I've never taught biblical Hebrew before. And she wrote back to me. She's like, "Aren't you a rabbi? Like, what do you guys do?" And so I said, "Well, you know, the community that I grew up in, the Orthodox Jewish community.
I mean, you're a rabbi in America. You speak English,
exactly, exactly."
But also in the Orthodox community, people go to school, Jewish school, where they learn that all day. If I could interject with a joke, my grandmother is Israeli, and she was a Hebrew teacher in America, and she used to joke that if American kids were visiting the beach in Tel Aviv and they were drowning, or they were going to drown, they would start saying Hoshiana, Hoshiana, which is like save me in biblical Hebrew, but not something any Israeli would understand. So that's the answer.
Exactly. And like, so like, it, right. Exactly. The joke is like, you know, you get the passport control and you're like, Vayomer ani el ha passport person. Right. So So like, you know, very archaic biblical Hebrew. So anyway, what happened was, you know, I said, I'd love to do it. Could you recommend a textbook for me to use? And she very kindly did. And it's sort of this very standard academic textbook that's used in universities and colleges throughout the world to teach biblical Hebrew. And we started using it, and it was helpful, but very dry. And it didn't reflect the way, sort of the joys of the language. And so what I found myself doing every time we would be in class together, and we had a wonderful group of like, you know, five or six people, whatever it was. And I would find myself saying, well, here's what the textbook says to do. But you know, my daughter now, who's in third grade, here's how she's learning it in her, you know, Orthodox Jewish day school. And it was often a much more intuitive way of learning it. And what I eventually did was say, you know what, like, I keep talking about this third grade curriculum. Why don't we just use it? So, you know, ordered the Lahavin Lahaskil, you know, kind of yeshiva day school curriculum for learning Hebrew. We switched to that. And it's been totally, totally awesome. So the upshot of it was, yeah go ahead.
No, I mean, I was thinking as you're saying this, as you're telling the story, you know, so I grew up in an Orthodox home in Chicago. And obviously, you know, I'm thinking about Pesach, Passover, which is around the corner and about a week from when people, when this podcast will drop, people, it'll be Seder night. And over the years, of course, at home, our Seder was Hebrew, right? We read the Haggadah Hebrew. Right. You know, maybe we had the Art Scroll version that had the English translation. But over the years, now as an adult, I have had the opportunity to be at Seder's where we've read the Haggadah in English. And like we've gone around the table, and maybe you guys have also been to these kind of Seder's where everybody reads a portion and they read it in English. And it's like a total different experience, I feel. Right. It's part of the Hebrew thing is the words have like, it's not just translation, I feel sometimes. And I'm kind of thinking about that in the biblical sense. Like, you know, to learn the Bible in English is one thing. To learn it in Hebrew is a whole other experience, no?
100%. And so the cool thing was that the people in the class that we have, again, like all different backgrounds, mostly non-Jewish, I think mostly Christian, but some Jewish, you know, some are academics, some are, you know, just, you know, interested in this for fun. Some are in academics, but in totally different fields. I mean, it's just a really cool thing. And what happened was we went from 7 months ago, literally nobody in the class knew the alphabet, to today, you know, they're reading, Genesis chapter 22, the Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, and they're reading it more or less independently. I mean, it's like a pretty amazing thing. And so what I saw over the course of this was exactly what you just said, Yaakov, which is that, you know, these were folks for the most part, not all, but most know the Bible better than your average Jewish person, I think, but they know it in English. And, you know, while that certainly gets across a lot that's important, I don't want to make it seem like you can't get anything out of the Bible in English. You certainly can, but there was so much of the artistry and the poetry and just the musicality of the Tanakh, of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, that they just didn't have access to. And every time we were able to see something like that, just like see how a key word repeats itself in important context, or to see how the Bible kind of calls back to itself in a way that you can only glimpse in the Hebrew, there'd be such joy and almost giddiness on the faces of everybody in the class, mine included, that I thought to myself, you know what, like this would just be a fun thing to show the world. So I did a little while back, I'd say it was like back in the end of December, sort of around the new year. I just did like a little thread on why read the story of Noah and the Tevav of Noah and the Ark and the flood in Hebrew. And I like, you know, I kind of did it like in the afternoon, and it was like right before New Year. So then kind of went out to do some stuff with the kids, went to sleep and turned on Twitter. Like, you know, I opened up Twitter the next morning and it was just like out of control. So it was a crazy thing. People were into it.
Who do you think it is? Most of these people who are into it.
Yeah.
You think these are Jews, they're Christians, they're a mix. Who do you think's looking at? Like, where's this hunger coming from?
So I've done, I think like 6 or 7 of these now, and all of them get, you know, like around 1,000, almost some of them almost 2,000 likes. They get like, you know, a couple hundred thousand impressions. And my kind of very off the cuff, back of the napkin guesstimation is that I'd say it's, you know, 70% to 80% non-Jews. It's probably mostly Christians. And then, you know, like a good, then like 20% to 30% Jews who just, you know, love seeing this kind of stuff and are interested in the literary stuff as well. And I think that the interest here is like, this is a foundational civilizational text. I mean, forget religion, forget Judaism, Christianity, just like think civilizationally. I mean, this is the foundation of the West. and not just the West, but the West as well. And, you know, I'm an English speaker. So, you know, I get a lot of most of the people we're following are English speakers, although there's a very strong sort of Latin American contingent as well. But you know, this is an incredibly essential text for understanding the culture that we inhabit. And to the extent that that's true, not being able to access this text in its original language means that you're going to miss so much of what your culture is founded on. And so I think there's this real, and especially since we're living in an age now where, you know, authenticity is really important cultural currency. People want to feel like they're doing something real the right way. So being able to access a text in its original language, especially one as important to society as this, I think has a real allure to it.
So this seems to be part of a sort of trend. I don't love the word trend because it sounds like I'm mocking it almost, but there's more and more of a move among Christians, evangelicals, but also you're talking about, you know, the woman who started this with you was Catholic, to get more familiar with the Jewish roots of Christianity. And I feel like Jews have had mixed reactions to that. And on the one hand, I mean, B'nai Tzion's doing great things to try to build this sort of interfaith connection. And on the other hand, I remember, you know, it's almost Pesach, a year or two ago, there was an evangelical woman who had posted about her Passover Seder and she was serving challahs. And there were Jews of all stripes who were sort of outraged by this, who were like, you know, you don't know anything about us and stop trying to appropriate our religion. So, I mean, it's clear what B'nai Tzion's position is here, and I guess if you could explain why you think that it's important to build these connections and to encourage it.
Yeah, so I should clarify that latter example is a good instance of something that I think is bad, and not bad because it's like morally wrong, just because it's silliness, right? What I think is important here is that there's. If you kind of think about where, just take America, for example, where American cultural discourse is at. So, you know, if you go to university or if you, you know, or if you're just like a generally serious or like well-read person and someone tells you like, you should care about philosophy, right? You should care about the life of the mind. So your head is immediately going to go to Athens. Your head's immediately going to go to the Greco-Roman world. And when you think of like serious thought, that's where you go. Serious thinkers, that's where you go. Now, and even if you're the kind of person who like doesn't care about this, like you just care about like you're working at your hedge fund or whatever it is, like you still know in the back of your head that when it comes to being a serious thinker, like all real serious thought comes from the Greco-Roman world. And that's a shame. Like if you're taking philosophy 101, it's all Greco-Roman philosophy. And it's a shame because the other great pillar of Western civilization is the Hebrew pillar, comes from the Hebrew Bible and comes from the Middle East, in fact. And I think the impetus to kind of discover the Jewish roots of Christianity, there are like two ways that you could frame that. You could frame it as Christians trying to be more Jewish, which I don't think is helpful. Like if you're a Christian, like be the best Christian you can be. That's good. You should do that. And it's okay that our communities are different. And not only is it okay, it's good that our communities are different. We bring what Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory called the dignity of difference to building a better civilization. But if you are a Christian or really anybody in Western civilization trying to take more seriously the Hebraic roots of your civilization, and particularly if you're a Christian, the Hebraic roots of where you come from, of your original story, I think that's an incredibly important thing because a Western society that's cut adrift from its Hebraic roots, from its roots in the tradition and wisdom of ancient Israel, and that the Jewish people have stewarded for centuries, for millennia, I think we're shortchanging ourselves as a society. We're morally, intellectually, and culturally impoverished by cutting ourselves off from that. So to the extent that Christians or even people who aren't Christians are interested in exploring these roots, and doing so by looking towards the land of Israel as opposed to just looking towards Athens, I think that's incredibly important. And it's something that the Jewish people not only should welcome, but in the past have welcomed. Like the 18th century was sort of like the last, or rather the 17th century was the last peak of this in the Middle Ages, where like all the most serious people in England and even on the continent were studying rabbinic literature, where, like, you know, John Selden, one of the most important members of parliament during the English Civil War, a person whom both Oliver Cromwell and King Charles I were recruiting, trying to recruit to their side. whom John Milton called the most learned man in all of England, wrote a full-blown commentary on Masechet Sanhedrin and read on Tractate Sanhedrin from the Babylonian Talmud and was an incredible rabbinic scholar. I mean, people took our learning unbelievably seriously. And one of the great commentators on the Mishnah, another incredible work of Jewish wisdom, the Tiferet Yisrael, Rav Israel Lipschitz, who's just a standard commentary that we study on the Mishnah today, referred to the people, to the non-Jews who were pursuing this form of learning as Hasidim, as pious ones, as a reference to the rabbinic statement that Hasidei Umot HaOlam Yeshlam Chelek LaOlam Haba, as the righteous among the nations have earned a share in the world to come. So we've always looked fondly and generously upon people taking our tradition of wisdom seriously, and I think we should do so again.
What do you think about, you know, also the use of spirituality or the Bible in pop culture, right? Something that, I mean, you and I spoke a couple weeks ago and you were telling me about the story about Lecrae, who's one of the more famous rappers. But you see it kind of all over the place. I was reading a story recently about Chance the Rapper, who I only know because he was in a song with Justin Bieber, I think, that my kids played once.
It's good. Holy.
Who also like took a sabbatical to study Bible or something. I mean, like, how does that fit into everything that you were just saying?
Yeah. So I'm obsessed with this question. Look, we're at a moment in the history of pop culture where sort of the cutting edge of culture is meeting the cutting edge of seeking after faith in the Bible. And Chance is a really good example of this. I mean, like that verse that he has on Justin Bieber's song Holy, where again, the chorus is holy, holy, holy. It's sort of mixing faith in God with faith in love and so on and so forth. And I remember playing pickup basketball at one of these sort of like middle-aged Jewish, you know, collective attempts to avoid heart attacks together, where we also play basketball. So I remember the son of a quite prominent Orthodox rabbinic figure, who himself is a very prominent rabbinic figure, just saying, "Oh my God, like Chance's verse on Justin Bieber's song is unbelievable Musser, right? Like it's incredible. It's incredible moral instruction." And he has this great line where he goes, where Chance is referring to God. He says, "I know I ain't leaving you. Like I know he ain't leaving us. I know we believe in God and I know God believe in us."
Right.
And it's coming from one of the biggest superstars on the planet. And it's not a mistake that this is happening now, whether it's Chance, whether it's Lecrae, whether it's Kendrick Lamar, another one of the biggest hip hop superstars on the planet who just played the Super Bowl. There's a reason why, and Justin Bieber, Carrie Underwood, Tori Kelly, Selena Gomez. There's a reason why all the biggest stars, in music, in sports, on screen, off screen, are taking this also seriously, because we're at a moment in history where we sort of got through sort of the fat years, to use a biblical reference from the book of Genesis. Like we've gotten through the fat years of like the 90s and the, you know, early 2000s, where everybody was making tons of money and it was, and you know, you didn't really need anything other than yourself. And by the strength of my hand, we earned all of this by ourselves. And you don't need tradition. You don't need wisdom. You don't need faith and spirituality. And you don't need the Bible. And you don't need your synagogue or your church. And then when everything came crashing down, not only did we face the famine years, but we did it without any of the spiritual resources that our grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents had when they faced even bigger catastrophes. And so it's not a mistake that you see rising depression, rising suicide rates, rising use of drugs. And while obviously those are not sort of monocausally explicable phenomena, it certainly has a great deal to do with the fact that our society sort of, like I said, cut itself adrift from its most important spiritual resources. And so now you have this great revival where the most prominent figures in history in culture, who are representative, I think, of a generation, they are very publicly searching. They're searching for authenticity. They're searching for meaning. They're searching for something to give their lives purpose. And young people resonate with that.
So just to pick up your thread about the 90s and the early 2000s being a great time for Americans, at least economically, there's something else about that time, that sort of post-Cold War world order that is feels like it's unraveling right now with the war in Ukraine. And, you know, we see millions of refugees escaping Ukraine, and Jewish organizations have really stepped up to help the tens of thousands and possibly even hundreds of thousands of Jews leaving, but also just in general. And I guess I want to ask you, what do you think the Jewish response should be to such a massive humanitarian crisis?
It's a great question. Far be it for me to set policy for the Jewish world. But what I can sort of supply some of the ways that I think about this. Number one, I think it's important to recognize the role that Ukraine as Ukraine plays in this. So Ukraine has undergone this truly astonishing shift from a Jewish perspective. So when I got married, my family's actually from an area that was once Poland is now Ukraine. For my bar mitzvah, I didn't have a traditional bar mitzvah in America with a DJ. I didn't even have friends. I went with my father and my grandfather to Ukraine. And I went to Lviv actually, and we spent Shabbat there, and I read from the Torah in the synagogue there. While we were there, one of the places we went was to Babi Yar, which is the site of one of the most horrific massacres of Jews during the Holocaust, where just for like a day or two, soldiers just sat there and one by one gunned down Jews and shoved them into a ditch. We visited Babi Yar. My father, unbeknownst to me at the time, gathered up some of the dirt and ashes from Babi Yar and put it in a small bottle. At my wedding, so the tradition, at least in our family and in many Jewish families, is for the chatan, for the groom, to sort of smear ashes on his forehead as an additional remembrance of the things that our people have lost, even at a time of great joy. And he gave me the ashes from Babi Yar to put on my head.
Okay, so I was going to say that after, when you started telling the ashes thing, and what an, you know, what a bar mitzvah trip. Like, there are people who go to the Caribbean, right, Hawaii, on a safari.
It was something.
And you go to Babi Yar, and I was going to say, oh, he collected the ashes to give you a gift for your wedding.
Right.
And then there you go. Right.
Exactly. It was definitely one of the better wedding presents that we got. And so all of which is to say, like, Ukraine has an incredibly dark history when it comes to its Jews. And so I don't think it's right to say Jews and Israel and so forth owe Ukraine because of how wonderful Ukraine's been to Jews. Ukraine has actually been quite terrible to its Jews. However, it makes it all the more miraculous that in its recent past, Ukraine has kind of gone from Babi Yar to a country that has a Jewish president who is openly warm towards Israel and whom the country is rallied behind. And I think the reason that we sort of all, and I don't want to speak for the whole Jewish community, but I, and at least anecdotally, so many Jewish people that I know either personally or see on social media, the reason that we feel so warm towards and drawn to Ukraine, I think is not because we have this long, amazing history with them, but precisely because they've gone from, you know, genut to shevach, from degradation to praise, to sort of crib from the Passover story. It's sort of like the reverse of Egypt, right? Egypt in the book of Genesis goes from this incredibly magnanimous, generous, charitable society to a slave driving cesspool. Ukraine has sort of done the opposite, and it makes it important to help. The second thing I'd say is that particularly, you know, at Passover, which is in many ways like a holiday, the holiday of refugees, right? So it's the holiday when we're marking the story of our people becoming refugees and leaving Egypt. So of course, on the one hand, and this may be trite, but it's important to say it anyway, this, particularly this time of year, we need to be we as a people who have that as a part of our history and a part of our story and a founding component of our national identity, we need to be sensitive to that and do everything we can to help those who are in positions similar to those that we were in so many thousands of years ago. But I would also add that, and to kind of bring in the pop culture. So like the two great versions of the Passover story in the Hollywood tradition are the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston and the Prince of Egypt from DreamWorks. And I love both of them, but the Ten Commandments is so far superior. And the reason is because the Ten Commandments as a movie understood that you cannot tell the story of the Exodus without also telling the story of Sinai. Whereas the Prince of Egypt just tells the story of the Exodus, and you see Moses getting the Ten Commandments like for literally half a second while the credits are rolling. And the difference between those two ways of telling the story is that Cecil B. DeMille, who directed the Ten Commandments, understood that the Exodus story is not just a story of people fleeing oppression, v'zehu. It's a story of people not just running away from something, but also running towards something. There is a purpose for their fleeing. Like there actually is an ideology. There's a mission. There's a vision behind what they're doing. They're not just running from somewhere. They're running to somewhere as well. And that's what Sinai represents. The Prince of Egypt was just about like, we all just got to get away from oppression. Just say no. So I think at this moment, what's so interesting about it and so potentially powerful about it is not just that there's a refugee crisis, which is the, you know, in terms of hierarchy of needs, the thing that we need to deal with first and foremost, but also to Lahav's point about it, kind of like a post-Cold War order, what's the ideology that we're all coalescing behind? What are we actually going to build out of this crisis? It would be a shame for this to just be another crisis that we have to deal with. Like, what's the uniting philosophical, ideological, missional element of this? Meaning, I would imagine that it's standing up for a world of democracy or liberalism against sort of a world order that sees sort of China and Russia as its pole stars, representing sort of authoritarianism and repression. But it could be something else that I'm missing. But I think it's important for us to sort of have a unifying worldview behind this so that it's not just the first half of the Passover story running from Egypt, but the second half as well, journeying towards Sinai and eventually towards the land of Israel.
All right. Well, on that note, that hopeful and inspiring note, we have to wrap up. So thank you so much, Rabbi Dr. Lam, for being on our show. And I want to wish you and all our listeners a happy Passover.
And Chag Sameach. Happy Passover.
Chag Sameach. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, stay safe.